Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of the Matt Rich Podcast. Today I have a special guest, Darren Earnshaw. How you doing?
I'm good, mate. Thanks.
You want to tell the listeners a little about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a specialist physical therapist, or as we say back where I'm from in Australia, physiotherapist.
Okay.
And my specialty is sort of musculoskeletal rehab and pain, basically, which is how I met you.
Yes, yes. Our story of how we meet is actually pretty... And from my point of view, it's miraculous. Like, you were a lifesaver to me and saved me a lot of years of suffering from pain. So for those who don't know, I was in an injury maybe 6 or 7 years ago. What the chiropractor thought happened was I dislocated 6 ribs in my back. He called them rib subluxations.
Yep.
And so the chiropractor, I continued to see him, and I was not getting better, and my front sternum started splitting as he would adjust my ribs in the back, and it was just a downhill slope. Like, the pain was increasing every day. It was getting hurt to breathe, and I just had no end in sight. So I started seeing other specialists, and one doctor said I had blown discs, and he said there's no rib subluxations. Another doctor said he doesn't see anything on the x-rays, and my back looks fine. So I was extremely lost on where to go. And so I finally spent a little bit more money and went to a doctor at Rush, and they recommended you. And that's how I found you.
Yeah.
So I came to your office, and the first therapy session, whatever you'd want to call that with you, I swear I walked out of that office with about 30% less pain just from one session. And now I would like to tell the listeners what happened. Like, that is... what you did is still blows my mind. And I guess we could start from there. Like, what did you see when you saw me come in?
Well, I think the doctor you saw at Rush, I had spoken to at some point somewhere, and we were talking about how there are certain patients who they get what we call catastrophized by the medical profession, where you're told a whole bunch of stuff based on x-rays or MRIs, or chiropractors have a certain philosophy on what can be going wrong with you. And you were told you had subluxating ribs and you had discs and all this sort of stuff. So the average person is probably pretty confused and scared by that.
Yeah.
And so the key for me is, if I get your story properly,
mm-hmm.
I can pick up if that's you. So when I spoke to you, I picked up that was probably more your problem. Now, other people come in and they may just have, I was in a motor vehicle accident 3 weeks ago, and my neck's a bit stiff here,
mm-hmm.
and I'll pick up that they don't have that sort of problem, and we can do a different approach. But with you, I picked up that you were confused and you were fearful of all the things you've been told, and
yeah.
this fear was stopping you from moving, and you, every time you felt some pain, you equated it with damage and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Which the medical profession is quite good at turning certain people into these sort of patients.
And what did you call it?
We catastrophize you. So
yeah.
we tell you stuff, and we don't mean to do it, but because for us, we might say you've got a bit of a degenerated disc. As soon as you hear the word degenerated, that sounds pretty bad to
yeah.
the average guy.
Mm.
To us, it's like, well, everyone over the age of 40 has degenerative things in their body. It's called aging and getting older.
Yeah.
So we tend to say these things to you sometimes flippantly and not realizing that it's quite can go into your brain and become a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And at other times, we believe this stuff ourselves and we believe it's a big problem. And at times it is, but a lot of the research now coming out is showing that you can have rotator cuff tears, you can have meniscal tears in your knee, you can have stuff all over your body. And like I said, it can just be normal aging. There's plenty of people out there who come in off the street and they've got disc bulges and things like that, and the researchers take them off the street, they have no pain, they MRI them for the research, and they find all this stuff in people's bodies, but they're in no pain.
Hmm.
So if you're going to make the assumption as a physician or a physical therapist, chiro, that what we see on x-ray or MRI, that is why you have pain, that can be a problem, because sometimes that may not be why you have the pain, or it may be, yeah, you flared up a disc that looked pretty well the same 3 weeks before, you flared it up,
mm.
but you had no pain. you flared it up, and now we're telling you you've got this big bulging disc, and your brain just goes, oh my God, now you don't want to bend your back, and you start thinking, you know, bad thoughts. Mm. And we can talk about pain a bit more in a minute, but you could, you know, when you start thinking like that, you can amplify your own pain.
Yeah.
Because pain's a sensation, is an experience you have mainly in your brain.
Hmm.
So you came in and you were having all this sort of stuff going on. So my primary goal was to convince you, you don't have to worry about all this stuff as much. I mean, you're a young guy.
Yeah.
You'd had a motor vehicle accident X years beforehand, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Most things heal. Mm-hmm. You know, I could chop my arm off in 6 months, my stump's healed. It's sensitive, but it's healed. Yeah. So tissues heal, and why are you still in pain? I felt that you were still in pain because you had all these messages coming from health practitioners telling you that you were broken, basically.
Yeah.
So we convinced you you weren't broken. We did some exercises. I might have done a bit of hands-on stuff to assist mm-hmm. the process. And then from what I remember, you gradually got better, because I think as you did more and you realized you didn't break down and fall apart,
yeah,
what I was saying was true.
Mm-hmm.
And now you seem to be doing okay, from what I can tell.
For sure. So, yeah.
So
what you're saying is basically like I was living in an illusion of amplified pain, like pain that was more, like my brain made it worse than what it really was.
Yeah, I think you had two things going on. Like, so pain is an experience in your brain, really. I mean, when I stab my leg with a knife, I see the knife go in, and there's a signal coming from where the skin is broken and the muscle is penetrated and stuff. That signal goes to my brain, and my brain has to interpret that signal.
Hmm.
And if I'm sitting there watching a knife go in my leg, I'm going to get a pretty strong signal that it hurts.
Yeah.
Now, if I was in a war zone, and I'm more worried about getting shot or blown up, and you're my compatriot, and you accidentally stab me in the leg with a knife, I may not even feel it.
Yeah.
So the signal's there, but because I've got other things going on, my brain will just ignore it for a while. So your brain can rev pain up, and your brain can rev the sensations down.
Yeah.
So what we're finding with the research, there's a ton of research coming out now on this stuff, is if you're in pain for a long time, your system just becomes messed up. So now a innocuous push of my finger into an area where you're tender, which you just feel like my finger poking you, you'll interpret it as pain because you've been in pain for so long and your brain becomes hypersensitive to sensations.
Wow.
So part of it's subconscious, just like blinking is subconscious,
mm-hmm.
but you can, understanding pain can help you change that sensitivity level. So a lot of it is we've got to explain this stuff to you. So when you understand pain better, which it's quite a, you know, I'm shortening it down for the moment,
yeah.
but, and there's lots of resources I can reference people to, but once you understand pain, that helps. And also that allows you to then go out and do more things, and it'll desensitize that system. So
yeah.
Like I said, if I chop my arm off and I had a very sensitive stump after 6 months, if you don't touch the stump and you never touch it, if you bang it on a wall or something, it's going to really hurt.
Mm.
But if you rub it and you massage it over time, you're putting input into the system, your brain seeing that nothing bad's happening, it turns the volume down.
Wow.
And now you can bang it into a wall, it's not half as sensitive.
Wow.
So that's why, as a therapist, we need to explain this to you. We need to have you confident enough that you believe us and understand it, and therefore you will do the exercises we give you.
Right.
And then by exercising, you are moving and showing your mind, look, nothing catastrophic's happening here. I can do more. And after a period of time, hopefully, you're doing a lot more. Now, right. This varies on, you know, you're a young guy. That's why I thought this is your major problem. If you're 80, you can have arthritic joints. And they can, you know, I can tell you all, till the cows come home, hey, listen, it's all in your head that your knee hurts.
Yeah.
But actually, if you do a lot of walking and there's a lot of inflammation from a worn out joint, it doesn't matter. I tried this with my father, didn't work.
Yeah.
He needed a total knee replacement eventually.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to pick and choose what's appropriate. So listening to your story, that was what I thought, and it seemed to work well. Other people come in and see me, and I'll be, that's not their major problem. They may just have an actual injury that we just need to rehab. But the point being, pain is just, it's in your head as much as you're interpreting a signal.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean when I say that to people, you're crazy. It just means all pain's an interpretation in your head. Sometimes it's super valid. I mean, pain is our emergency system. It's letting us know that I've stood on a nail. I should probably take my foot off the nail.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps hurting. I should probably go and get it seen to so I don't get tetanus or an infection or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's an interpretation. You know, pain is just an interpretation of that signal. And in certain people, depending on you, because every person's experience of pain is different, it can be amplified. So if you and I stood on a nail, I'd probably rate it as a 10 out of 10. You might rate it as a 2 out of 10 because you've had a different upbringing from me. So our processing of those signals is unique for each person.
Interesting.
So your perspective of what a doctor tells you will be different from mine, from someone else's. So it's quite complex, and you've got to sort of, you are a brain attached to a body, and your brain is interpreting signal coming in, and how you interpret it is unique to you.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you can get over or bypass some of these things. Like what you were saying with chronic pain in general is a mechanism that we evolved with because it helps us heal, us survive.
You'd die without it, basically.
Yes.
You'd step on the nail and just keep walking around. Eventually you get an infection, die, or something else.
I actually had a cousin who was born with, like, I don't know if he was born with low pain receptors pain receptors, but as a little child he would hold a light bulb and fry his hand, and the parents wouldn't know he's injured because he wouldn't cry or nothing like that.
There's a syndrome. I forget the name of that syndrome, but that is dangerous.
So you could see the dangers of that. You could have like an infection going and not know. So chronic pain is where this can apply. Not all chronic pain, if it's legit, like worn out joints or actual physical things, but chronic pain, a lot of it is almost a defense mechanism in your head. So in my situation, I was so scared to re-injure my injury that it felt like I was creating this cloud of I was putting it in a bubble, bubble boy. I was making sure I never bent in a certain way, I never moved a certain way, and that just made it super sensitive.
Yeah.
So it created like this illusion of more pain than I was in.
It's interesting because the guy that I sort of put me onto this is a couple of guys who, I think I showed you the videos. There's a guy called Peter O'Sullivan from, he's actually a New Zealander, but he lives in Perth where I'm from, and he's done a PhD on a lot of stuff, and he's like the new pain guy.
Hmm.
And he has if your listeners want to reference him, they can just Google Peter O'Sullivan, low back pain, and he has a brilliant video explaining all this stuff. But what he's found with a lot of low back pain patients is that actually they have increased tension around their core, because they're that petrified because the doctors have told them that they've got herniated discs and all this sort of stuff. So naturally, if your brain processes this, like cognitively, like consciously, you go, oh my God, my back is fragile and I could damage it by moving, you become very rigid. Hmm. So your core's on all the time. Now, if your core's on all the time, it's going to hurt even more, because if you have a very... like if you hurt your wrist and you just tensed your wrist the whole time and then you moved it, if you had an injury, it would be worse. Yeah. So part of his thing is he has to explain to people you need to relax, they need to relax. He gets them moving. When he gets them moving and they move without pain, they think, oh my God, you know, by relaxing I have less pain, and he can have very miraculous things. Now, this is not all back pain patients.
Yes.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that over the last 10, 15 years, the things that we've been sold a lot of is if you've got back pain, you've got to make your core stronger.
Hmm.
Well, if you were that sort of back pain patient where you're holding your core all day long and that's part of the reason you have pain, doing core exercises is not what you need. Yeah. You need to probably relax and just let your core relax. So now that's one sort of patient.
Yes.
Now another guy might come in where he probably could use a bit better strength around his core or changing the way he moves.
Hmm.
All that comes from a practitioner who understands there's different sorts of patients. And when you examine the patient and you get a good subjective interview where you're talking to them, you start to think, oh, he sounds a bit like this guy, or he sounds a bit like that guy. So if you apply the wrong tool to the wrong patient, it doesn't work. So if your chiropractor is manipulating your ribs and you've had pain for 7 years and he's telling you all these things, he's probably going down the wrong road. But if you'd hurt yourself a month ago and you had a bit of a stiff back and he gives it a bit of a crack, because you'll hear the stories all the time with chiropractors, and I manipulate people too, you can have a miraculous result there too. But you've got to work out who's what. And the way to work it out is do a really good sit-down interview with them. And what's happening in medicine today is I think we're losing a bit of that. I think a lot of the just health practitioners in general don't spend enough time getting the story of the patient. And you have to get really into it. And then they rely too much on imaging studies and things like that, which are great. They're very important and more important in certain patients than others.
Like x-rays and MRIs?
Yeah, yeah. They're all useful, but you've got to sort of utilize them in this sort of big picture, that sometimes the findings that you get may be irrelevant. They may be a red herring. You might have neck pain and you might have a disc at C5-6 that's bulging a little bit, but you might have had that for 10 years and your neck pain is due to the fact you've been sitting at your computer for 5 hours more a day. So the only way I'm going to find that out is by asking you, when did it start? Where's it hurting? What have you done different? So, you know, my subjective interview takes probably 2 to 3 times as long as my physical assessment. Because usually my physical assessment, I work off the subjective. And they've done research on this where they observe novice clinicians versus experts. The experts will take 30 minutes to do a good subjective and then about 10 minutes on the physical. It's the other way around with the novices. They do a very short subjective. Then they measure everything under the sun because they've been taught to measure everything.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, what's wrong with them? They don't know, but they've measured everything under the sun. And that's fine if you're a new grad, but you shouldn't be operating like that at 20 years out sort of thing. And I still see that in some guys. So,
did you get your doctorate in Australia?
I'm not a doctor of physical therapy. Although I'm actually doing a transitional doctorate. I've been doing it for so long, mate. 28 years I've been doing this. Back in Australia, it was a Bachelor of Science.
Okay.
Then I went back after a few years and did a specialty degree, which is the equivalent of a fellowship over here. At that point, it was called manipulative therapy. We cracked people, but it wasn't purely manipulation. A lot of it was just a whole bunch of stuff, not just manipulation. And then over here, a few years ago, I did another fellowship in movement science because I felt that I was missing a few components. So when I assess somebody, I'm sort of trying to work out after I've heard the story, are they more of a person who will respond to me just, you know, loosening up a joint or hands-on techniques? Or are they more of a person who is having pain because they move in a way that puts too much stress on an area and I have to change the way they move? So I might give you exercises, stretch stiff muscles, strengthen weak muscles. Or are they more like what you came in like, where your primary problem was that you were so worried from everything you'd been told, you wouldn't move and exercise. So you were easy. It was just like once I convinced you needed to move, you just started exercising. And the exercises were not particularly special exercises. Other people will need very specific exercises. So, you know, you might have pain in your back. And if you have a sway back type posture, for instance, what that means is your back sort of curved backwards too much. You might put too much load on the joints and they hurt after you stand for a long period. I see a lot of people like this. So I have to sort of strengthen some muscles and stretch some muscles and give you some exercises to slightly change that posture so that you take load off the joints. And usually it's a mix of everything, but it's like, what's the dominant problem? So you were dominantly worried about what you've been told about that area of your back.
Yeah.
Therefore, you weren't moving it, and it actually probably needed some movement. Once we convinced you to move and you saw that you were doing better, you got better.
Yeah.
Other people come in and they might have, like I said, a sway back, and I've got to give them the exercises. They've got no weird thoughts in their head about things. They just need some exercises. Other people, you just move, you get your fingers stuck into a joint and move it around, and for whatever reason, and there's a whole debate on that, they feel better. So you, but again, it all goes back to listening. You know, a good health practitioner will listen to your story, and hopefully they've got a breadth of knowledge to be able to work out where you fit.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you're a new grad, you come out with a certain approach. So you might have two tools in your toolbox. So everything you see, you're trying to use those two tools for. But as you get more exposure to things and you get more tools in your toolbox, you can start to work out which tool is right for that particular patient. Now, the problem sometimes is that health practitioners go out and they do tons of courses and get lots of treatment tools, but they're not very good at working out when to use the tool. So they almost throw the toolbox at you, or they still go back to whatever the latest tool is they've got.
Interesting.
What I've worked out is if you listen to your patient well, and then you're a good thinker, we call it clinical reasoning, you work out which tool to use. Now, if you're going to hang a shelf on a wall, and you're, all you know about are nails and hammers, you're going to get a nail and a hammer, and the thing's going to fall off the wall probably. But if you've been introduced to screws and special drywall fasteners, and you've got more breadth of knowledge, you'll be like, well, or maybe it's a concrete wall, and you've got to have some knowledge about how to get a thing in a concrete wall. I can't remember what the hell you call that, but it's a masonry bit. The days of working for my father have paid off. but if you know those tools, you can do a better job. So you've got to have and that's what experience brings. So you've got to have experience. But I know a lot of experienced practitioners who they don't keep learning, and they don't expand their toolbox, and they are still doing the same stuff they were doing 30 years ago. And that's the problem today, is when you go out, there's still a lot. I mean, physical therapists and chiropractors and osteopaths, we're the worst offenders, some of us. We are telling people what your chiro was telling you, that you've got subluxated joints. And I have tons of therapy people that I work with who believe this, the pelvis goes out of alignment, and they tell people that. They're like, your sacroiliac joint's out of alignment. Now, you know, in very rare cases, that may happen. But a lot of the research is showing us it probably doesn't happen. And you're not helping someone by telling them that. Because it's, if I tell you your pelvis is out of alignment, I personally would be thinking that joint has popped out of alignment. And then I'm not going to want to do much because I'm all scared about this joint. Whereas I'd rather tell someone, even if I think the sacroiliac joint's a bit irritated, I might just say, you know, that joint seems a bit irritated. I'm going to give you some exercises. You'll do fine. I need to give you a messaging that you're going to get better.
For sure.
Not, you're out of alignment. You need me to realign you. It's a good business model.
For sure.
You have to keep coming back.
It is, yeah.
But a lot of people don't get better. And, and you get stuck in this perpetual cycle of, I need to go and see my chiropractor or osteopath or physical therapist to realign me, when in fact I should be saying, here's a bunch of exercises, get into the gym, I'll give you appropriate exercises. Because, you know, just blanketly going out and exercising sometimes isn't right for everybody, you know. So that's where, like, my skill set is, I know exercise, I know pathology. If I think you need to get into an exercise program in the gym, which I encourage everyone to, I might think, okay, you've got a bit of a knee that you've had two meniscal surgeries on. Probably running isn't the thing for you. Doesn't mean you can't run, but every time you do run, you get pain. So maybe we'll give you bike, elliptical, and I can set a program up that sort of is right for you. But I do think that the medical profession is, and PTs are quite good at it too, at catastrophizing people. And the latest research, if you read it, is that a lot of the old models, that's why chiropractic is seen as a outside model. And I know lots of chiropractors who are brilliant. And in fact, a lot of the younger guys who don't buy into the you're out of alignment sort of stuff, they're pretty well similar to what I am.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing the same stuff. So we've done research where someone comes in and they have neck pain, you crack their neck, they have no pain, but then you re-x-ray it, you do an x-ray beforehand, you do an x-ray afterwards, and everything's in the same position, but they feel better. So the out of alignment theory obviously wasn't correct.
So there's not a strong correlation from images on a pain of images on a X-ray.
You know, my understanding is chiropractors look at X-rays and they find all this stuff, and then they tell you they got to crack this and do this and do that. And this is just some chiropractors.
Yes,
there's like a large breadth in there, and they've got their own little subgroups in there. But so they will then go and manipulate you or whatever, telling you I've made you feel better because I've realigned things.
Mm.
And there's been research done where we look at them after the manipulation and everything's exactly where it was before. Hmm. So we're not sure what the mechanism is, but you feel better.
Yeah, it's a little sometimes. Placebo, it yeah. sounds like.
Could be a placebo. It could be that there is such a small, tiny little subluxation that it, you know, something's just so minimally out of whack that you can't pick it up. I think there's lots of different subcategories in there. I don't worry as much about it now, you know, but one of the traps that you fall into is if you think you know why you got someone better, you can't laterally think outside the box. You're stuck in your box. So we talk about the system that I teach. We talk about a black box. I interview you. I do some tests. And then I might decide I want to do an intervention. I do the intervention. Let's say I do manipulate your neck or your back or whatever. You feel better, which is the output. But what goes on in the box, we don't really know. It could be any number of things.
Mm.
If I think I know what goes in the box, which some practitioners do, they're like, well, I just realigned your neck. Then they can't entertain the thought process that, well, maybe actually I didn't. Maybe it's more of just a pain inhibition or placebo or maybe I shouldn't be telling this guy that because I'm going to turn him into like a patient that's worried about stuff. So. Mm. It's a life philosophy. If you ever think you know the answer to something, when you're completely convinced that you're right, you can never think outside your box.
Yeah. I mean,
you could turn it into a political podcast.
Yeah.
You could turn, you know, religion, politics. It's all based on belief systems of what you believe, how the world works.
Yeah.
And then health practitioners have a belief on how the body works and what they need to do. And the biggest thing I learned in my fellowship, my original fellowship, was that you've got to have a very open mind and be non-dogmatic.
Yeah.
And then, so then as you progress through your life and as I progress through my career, I can entertain other approaches or something else might be explaining why that works.
So it sounds like you're kind of approaching it with an agnostic point of view.
Yeah.
Being flexible and open to different ideas when it's presented to you, which is... I feel like that's not being done a lot in America, or at least not being taught through our medical.
Australia's sort of the same in a way.
Is it? Do they have the opiate problem?
There's agnostic, and what's the other one that's not even quite an agnostic? I never say I'm an agnostic. You are. Agnostic's correct.
Yeah.
I'm thinking an atheist.
Yeah,
so an atheist is convinced they know the answer. There is no God.
Yeah, which is basically a religion.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sort of agnostic on everything. It's sort of like, yeah, you know, I just don't know.
Yeah.
So that's my philosophy. If I don't know, then I can entertain other possibilities.
For sure.
And I see, not just in physical therapy, but I see in life, that people who are absolutely convinced their way of thought is the only way, it can be a problem at times.
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, when I went into my fellowship, I basically thought I was going in to be told how to differentiate this structure from that structure from this structure, and this will make me a better therapist. And I came out the other end thinking, man, they didn't really show me how to differentiate anything. Everything's grey. That makes you a better practitioner.
Hmm.
If you recognise that everything's grey, you've got flexibility in your thought process and you can move around. And if you this approach isn't helping that person, you've got other options.
Hmm.
You know, sometimes things are black and white. Fall over, you break a bone sticking out through your arm. I'd say, yep, your arm's probably hurting because that bone's sticking out through it, you know.
Yeah.
We should do a surgery, fix it. You know, in that case, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
But for someone who comes in and says, look, I was doing some weeding in the garden and now my shoulder's killing me. The doctor got an MRI and it showed a rotator cuff tear. Now the person hears the word tear and thinks, well, how do you fix a tear? If you've got a tear in your pants, the only way to fix it is to sew it up. So therefore, I need a surgery. Well, that's not necessarily true because, as I said before, we're dragging people off the street and doing MRIs on their shoulders and they're in no pain. And over the age of 40, a very large percentage of them have rotator cuff tears. And then you go on MRI. So people who have pain in a shoulder, they MRI and they've got a rotator cuff tear. They then MRI the other shoulder, and most of them had a rotator cuff tear in the other shoulder.
Wow.
So is the tear the reason you've got the pain, or is the tear just an incidental finding? And maybe you stirred up another tendon or a bursa or something. Or is the tear relevant, but it's just a little bit inflamed, and then once the inflammation goes down, you've got a tendon with a tear in it that works perfectly well, because we know they can work perfectly well with tears in it. So one of my doctors that I work with uses the analogy of you've got a piece of rope, you put a nick in the piece of rope, you can still pull the bucket out of the well. The little bit of fraying and nick in the rope doesn't change it. It works perfectly well. Mm-hmm. But if that is inflamed, which is what sometimes happens when you do too much or you maybe just strain it, it'll hurt. So how do we get it back to no inflammation and just a nick in the rope that still works perfectly well? Yeah. Now, if the rope's completely cut, you've got a complete massive rotator cuff tear, different story. So, and then sometimes that, if it's a big enough nick, it can become a problem. Mm-hmm. So that's why nowadays a lot of insurance companies won't let you go and have an MRI until you've done 4 weeks of therapy, because they're reading the research and they're saying you're actually prognostically, so predicting your outcome, you're worse off, they've shown, knowing your MRI findings up front, because as soon as you know you've got a tear, you go to therapy, you've almost decided, I'm not going to get better.
Yeah.
So that's why they do that. Now, I do get patients where it's so obvious I'm not going to be able to help them, and I'm just like, dude, you just need to go and get an MRI as the doctor has ordered. And sometimes I can convince it to happen quicker, but sometimes you just got to run them through their therapy. I've had people come in who tell me, I've got a bone spur on my heel, so I need a surgery. And I'm like, well, what happened? Well, I was pushing the snowblower a week and a half ago, and I got this sharp pain in the back of my heel. I went to the doctor, he told me I've got a bone spur, said I need a surgery, but I have to do therapy. And I'm like, well, you didn't just get the bone spur pushing the snowblower. That's been there for years. Huh. You've probably irritated it, just like I could go out and push the snowblower and strain something. I think I can get you better. But this person was convinced, because the physician had told her, you got a spur, we've got to take that down. Yeah. So I had no hope. I tried getting her better, but I didn't have enough time. She went and had a surgery. We rehabbed her. You know, after you have a surgery, you're in a boot for 6 weeks, and then we gradually build up your strength and all that stuff. I have a feeling if we just put her in a boot for 6 weeks and done the exact same thing like she'd had a surgery, she would have got better.
Wow.
That is the problem with a lot of the guys I see from the mill and the steel workers. I do my stuff and then they go straight back to work and they trash it again.
Mm-hmm.
So then eventually they end up having a surgery and they're in a sling for 6 weeks and then we rehab them. So they're off 3 to 6 months. Pretty sure if they didn't have the surgery and we did the same thing, certain percentage of those guys would get better. Now, not all of them.
Yeah.
And the problem is if you did do that and then they're still in pain and have to have a surgery, you've just wasted a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So it becomes, we don't really know. Why does one guy come in with quite a big tear and no pain and another guy comes in with a tiny little tear and more pain? And I think there's a whole bunch of factors playing into that.
For sure. Ever really know what causes the pain?
I don't know.
In certain situations,
it is not in my black box. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. So in Australia, we have direct access to physical therapists. So if you hurt your shoulder, you would just walk into the physio most of the time. We would try getting you better. And if you're not getting better, we might refer you on to a surgeon. What tends to happen in the US is you go straight to the surgeon who, if they're good, like the guys I work with are really good, they usually will send you to therapy for a while because they understand this stuff.
Yeah.
But if they don't understand this stuff, they may just say you need a surgery and then you go into the surgical realm. And if you get a good result, fantastic. But if I could have got the same result over the same period of time, I'm a lot cheaper. So when you start looking at healthcare costs and things like that, I think that the US has a few problems in that area.
Yeah.
Was
it the conspiracy side of me wants to say, wants to believe that this is, some of it could be intentional. Like they pry on the idea of pain because it creates longer customers, especially if they're on pills.
I think there are some practitioners out there who probably understand what we're talking about and do that. But I honestly think that a lot of it's just that if you're trained a certain way, like if you're a surgeon, you do surgery. If you're a PT, you do PT. So I really, this is why the insurance companies are insisting, they're taking it away from, they're trying to prevent people going down that path.
Save some money, right?
Well, saves them money, yeah. Absolutely. But actually can be very beneficial for the patient because, especially, you know, when you I get patients who've had five surgeries or three surgeries and you sort of think, man, if they had maybe not gone down that path of that first surgery that they may not have needed or if they had seen me first. And it depends. Some of them you're like, yeah, that guy needed surgery.
You're right.
But other guys you're like, you just had a bit of back pain after a car accident and it wasn't going down your leg and you didn't have numbness and tingling and you had a spinal fusion. I mean, I just can't believe that sort of stuff goes on sometimes.
Wow.
Which sort of segues into that whole opioid thing that we've discussed before. In the past, the physicians would give them drugs. You're in pain, I'll give you drugs. Now, opioids were never meant to be long-term. The pharma companies sort of, I think, tweaked some of the research or sold some of the research that showed that people didn't get addicted to opioids when they're in pain. Mm. And that was done, that research was done on short-term acute pain in hospital.
Wow.
So if you're on opioids for 6 years, that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people who are still in a lot of pain usually, now addicted to opioids, maybe if we got them into the right sort of practitioners in the first place where you've got a bunch of people sort of managing it and they have someone like me explaining pain to them, then getting them into an appropriate exercise program and the doctors are communicating the same message, some of those people may not go down that road, that dark road of, you know, they're in chronic pain and opioid addiction and stuff. Maybe,
yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes,
and there's a lot of research coming out showing that's the way to sort of
treat
with that. Yeah.
That is crazy. So how does it affect the brain? How does pain affect the brain compared to how it affects the body?
So pain is just, if you say I have pain in my foot, that is your brain's interpretation of some signal, or it doesn't even have to be signal sometimes. So think about amputees. Amputees often describe they have pain in their arm, but they don't have an arm.
Like a phantom arm?
Correct, yeah. So the latest thing on phantom limb pain, we used to think that it was the, you know, when you amputate someone's arm, the nerves at the end of the stump are being irritated and sending a message. But what they're now sort of thinking is that there's what they call, it's a non-scientific term, but smudging in the brain where the neurons that would define that area of the arm are no longer getting input. So they want input. So they start looking for input from other parts of the brain.
Wow.
Or something like this. I'm certainly not the guru on pain neuroscience, but so you can actually stroke some of these guys' face, which lies very close to the arm in that brain map, and they'll think you're stroking their arm and they don't even have an arm.
Wow.
So you can get this smudging in the brain, and this has led some practitioners to use mirror therapy with amputees where they'll actually put a mirror next to the stump. And then you've got your other arm that you actually have an arm on. And when you look in the mirror, it looks like you've got an arm on the end of your stump.
Whoa.
So, and a lot of these people feel like they want to move their limb, you know, but they don't have a limb. So how do they move something that doesn't exist? So then you get them to move the arm they have, they see it in the reflection and it's like they're moving the arm on that the stump doesn't have. and they get relief.
Wow.
So you can use this in other different weird pain syndromes as well. But it demonstrates that pain is the interpretation is happening in your brain.
Yeah.
And I've got pictures in my clinic of a skull, an X-ray of a skull with a nail up the nose. I think I don't know.
Yeah, if
I
showed this you. Is a crazy story.
Yeah, and I'm like, that guy didn't know he had a nail up his nose till he went to the dentist and he had his checkup. And they're like, you know, you got a nail in your head. And what had happened was, this particular guy had been a builder or something. He's checking his nail gun. So he's, I mean, I don't know why you would look at the your nail gun, but this guy did. It fires off two nails. They go in quick succession. He sees one enter the beam above him and he thinks, whew, that was close. Meanwhile, one's gone up his nose.
Whoa.
But because his brain thought he got away with it, it's just basically shut the pain down.
That's insane.
So then I got another picture of a foot with a nail X-ray, and it looks like it's gone through the guy's foot. And with this guy, same thing. He shot the nail gun off accidentally into his boot and foot, or so he thought. They take him to the they have to anaesthetize him to get his boot off to have a look. And when they take his boot off, the nail's gone so perfectly in between his toes, it hasn't even broken the skin. So he hasn't got an injury at all, but this guy thought he had a bad injury. So his brain's just gone, dude, you know, maximal pain. I'm going to send you a message like, danger, danger. So you can see how your brain can rev up or rev down based on circumstances. So again, it goes back to in their sort of extreme cases, but in generally, if you had like a whiplash injury or something like that, your whole you as an individual decides how you're going to interpret the pain that's coming in from your neck. Think about demolition drivers. They get smashed up like you wouldn't believe. Mm-hmm. If anyone should have whiplash and chronic bad neck pain, a demolition driver should, but most of them don't.
And there's no correlation. Like, there's not a disproportionate amount of drivers
not,
like that.
Yeah, they're not all walking around in collars and stuff, but then someone gets rear-ended in a car park at 5 miles an hour and they're in a collar and in massive amounts of pain.
Wow.
And it's contextual. Like the demolition guy knows he's going to get whipped around, so he's not particularly worried about it. He's probably got a bit of a sore neck and stuff.
Yeah.
But when you get rear-ended, and depending on you as an individual, if you're that sort of person who, as you were brought up, pain was sold to you as being a catastrophic thing, you might have a worse result than the kid who falls over and the parents just say, get up, Johnny, and keep running. So a whole, you know, like I said before, you and I could have the exact same injury, but our interpretation of the signal can be much, much different.
Yeah.
And then also how you think about it consciously, like you were consciously thinking bad thoughts about your back.
Yeah.
So at one level, there's a subconscious rev up of your pain system. And then consciously, you're also thinking things that may prevent you from doing what you need to do to get better.
Yeah.
So
it's not like someone has a higher threshold of pain or higher pain tolerance. It's that they just have a tougher way of interpreting it, or it doesn't.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they do have a higher tolerance for pain, but it's based on a whole bunch of factors.
Yeah.
So runners, for instance, they've measured what pressure pain threshold. So you can get a device that you poke into your arm, and then at some point you go, ow, that's hurting, and it measures how hard you're pushing.
Hmm.
Okay, so at the beginning of the season with a runner, they go, ow, that hurts at, let's say, 10 pounds. After they've been training for a while, so they're what are they doing? They're gradually exposing their body to pain, aren't they? You know, and as they get fitter and fitter, they're able to tolerate more pain. Their pressure pain threshold changes.
Wow.
So then you push in and they're going at 50, they're going, oh, it's not hurting yet, sort of thing.
Wow.
So you can change pain, and that's sort of what we did with you.
Yeah.
Your joints and everything were so sensitive to any input that normally when you move would be just interpreted as I'm just moving some joints.
Yeah.
They were interpreting as pain. And part of that was consciously because you've been told a whole bunch of stuff by other medical practitioners.
Wow.
And then as you got moving more, we changed that pressure pain threshold probably. So
I already feel less pain already from this conversation.
Yeah. Now, sure again, I've had this, I remember having this conversation because what also happens in our profession is that whatever the latest fad is, everybody jumps on board it. So now you've got new grad practitioners who this is the new hot thing.
Sweet.
They're trying to talk everybody out of their pain. And that's fine if you fit that paradigm. But if you don't, it like me trying to tell my father that his badly arthritic knee, it's just in your head, just is stupid, really. So, yeah. I mean, if I blow your leg off with a shotgun, and then I'm just saying that sensation you're feeling is just in your brain, you know, it's a bit silly, isn't it?
For sure.
So you got to be able to pick and choose.
Yeah,
who,
yeah.
But I think it applies to everyone, because when I have a patient who has had surgery, a rotator cuff surgery, if I'm a practitioner who's super nervous and I'm like, oh, are you getting pain? Yes. Oh, well, we need to stop doing the exercises. But I know that actually, sorry, I'm nervous about it. I put that onto the patient. So then they become more nervous and their pain gets revved up. Whereas I know, having been in the game for a long time, that, okay, you've got to have a little bit of pain. So I'm constantly telling my patients, if it's appropriate, because in some cases when their pain flares up, I have to respect it and back off. But at other times, I have to say to them, look, you got to have a little bit of pain to sort of toughen that tendon up. Or if they're a frozen shoulder, you got to stretch into your pain or you're not going to get anywhere. But when I say to them, you're not damaging yourself. Like and I have to sell it. If I don't sound like I know what I'm talking about. So that's where the whole good health practitioners, the best that you see, their bedside manner or they can sell it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're different from the new grads who are a bit nervous and tentative.
Yeah.
And you sell it and you say, you're not damaging it. I just want a little bit of pain when you do this exercise. You're allowed to have some pain later, et cetera, et cetera. They tend to do much better than if you're going, oh my God, you're hurting a little bit, which is how I used to be back in the past.
Yeah.
I would not push people, certain patients hard enough. Now, having said that, you don't want to be pushing some patients too hard. Like, I have other therapists I know who crank on people way too early, too aggressively, and flare them up. And part of that, even if you know they've got to have pain, if you recognizing they may have that sort of personality type that pain freaks them out and all that, I may have to go a little bit slower and more gently than the next guy, where I'm like, this guy can just crank on his arm and stretch him aggressively. So a good practitioner understands all those things.
Interesting.
When you do it.
It reminds me of that psychological experiment, the Milgram experiment. It's like an unethical one they can't repeat anymore, but it's where a doctor would be in a white lab coat and he would tell people in this room to press a button. A person had to basically ask another person in a separate room they didn't see questions. And if this person got it wrong, they were hooked up to a shock like collar.
Yeah, yeah.
So the person had to crank up the shock collar. Every question they got wrong, it got gradually stronger and stronger. Yeah. And so this doctor was behind him saying, like, this person was on the other end. And it was all fake. The person on the other end was in on the experiment. But this person who was cranking the button up and shocking the other person didn't know that they were in on it. And so that they would fake scream as it got higher and pretend they were in torture.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And a freaky amount of people were completely okay with torturing another person if the doctor in the lab coat was giving them permission. And so there was a psychological phenomenon going on that shows that we take better advice or we believe it more if it's coming from a higher figure or if it's coming from an expert.
Yeah.
And so same thing with you. Like, the more you sell it, the more you're confident on it.
I remember that experiment too. I look at it too, that like a lot of people are just sheep. They'll just go along with stuff, you know. I would probably go along with it too and just about kill you, but there'd be certain individuals in there who would have just said, no, I'm stopping.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And they're a rare fish type thing. But they have done research where the longer your coat is, your white coat, the more the patient perceives that you know what you're talking about, like as physicians.
Wow.
So, you know, it goes to the, you know, we have jean day on Fridays. And I'm like, I never wear jeans, because if I have a newer patient come in and he's sitting in front of me and he doesn't know me from anybody and I'm sitting there in a pair of jeans, I'm already not helping myself sell that I know what I'm talking about.
Interesting.
So, you know, that's why doctors wear ties and coats and all this, and everything to do with everything is impacting that patient, so which a lot of people don't get. So I think that's an important part when you're selling stuff.
And your accent helps too.
Oh, probably. Maybe, mate. If I was English, I'd sound even smarter.
Yeah.
better accent.
So what are the benefits of learning about pain and rewiring the way we think about it?
Well, I think if you understand what we've been talking about as a healthcare practitioner, you've got a different tool in your toolbox.
Yeah.
So now I can recognize when someone comes in like yourself, who your main problem was that. Now in the past, I might have treated you like the chiropractor. Mm-hmm. You're hurting the middle of your back, in your thoracic spine. Let's poke it, prod it, manipulate it, put heat on it, ultrasound it, do everything you can do to that area. But there probably wasn't an issue in that area.
Yeah.
I mean, it had all healed up.
Yeah.
You just needed to have a bit of education and get moving again. So I think that you've got another tool in your toolbox, yeah, knowing that. But even if that's not your primary problem, if let's say you did have a joint on that side that was sore and I did need to poke it or manipulate it, still telling you, look, don't worry about it. You know, it's you're a young guy. It's going to heal up. Getting that messaging across stops you becoming that patient,
yeah,
is the other thing. Because we are creating patients. Therapists that tell patients things. I tell people all that we have a big debate in therapy whether sacroiliac joints can, or any joint for that matter, can be stiff or out of alignment or whatever. And some people think you can't even feel this stuff and it doesn't exist. Other people swear by it. Mm. So when I have this debate with the ones who swear by it, I say, look, you know, you can do your techniques where you think you're realigning something and the patient gets up and feels better. My problem has always been that often they feel better at the time, but it never sticks. Mm. And that's because you've probably placeboed them.
Yeah.
But you can do all that stuff, but please don't tell them they're out of alignment. Give them a different message so yeah. you don't turn them into the sort of patient like you,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah,
you
know? Definitely.
So if the chiro gave you a different message,
mm-hmm,
basically, look, you're a bit tender in your back, I'm going to crack it a few times, you're young, you're healthy, you'll be fine, I'll crack it, that'll loosen it up, now we'll get you exercising, let's get you back in the gym, you'll be fit, you're going to be, you don't have to worry.
Yeah, just pumping me up. Like
you'll go down the right track. If it's more the other message that you're out of alignment and you've got all these problems, you're never going to go and exercise, yep, and do any of that sort of stuff.
And that's what that worse. Middle doctor, after the chiropractor, when I was bouncing around different specialists, I saw a spine surgeon and he told me that I will forever be in pain,
yep,
because I let it go for too long, and yep, that I have blown discs in my back that I, yep, let go for too long. So that's when I was like, that was at my worst. That's, yep, when I was like, I felt like I got diagnosed with something crazy.
It does seem to be a big problem. I think America's a bit worse. You guys do more spinal fusions in America than anywhere else in the world, and you're not having that better success rates on back pain.
Hmm.
So I think this is how it's dealt with in America. Now, having said that, the guys I work with, I've seen plenty of spinal fusions, and when they're done on the appropriate patient where everything else has failed, they can work well, but they're a classic case. They have a spinal fusion, which to me is a sort of big surgery.
Yeah.
If you don't sort of realistically tell them, look, you're going to be sore and stiff for the next 6 months, don't worry about it, it's completely normal. Like I've had a patient last week, that's all they wanted to hear.
Hmm.
So they're panicking, thinking their back's hurting and something's wrong with the fusion, and I explain, no, that's completely normal. They were quite happy. They, yeah, still had the pain,
yeah,
but they were, oh, okay, no, yeah, no problem, I can put up with a little back pain.
Yeah.
But that person could have gone down a bad road where it's like, oh my God, what's going on? Blah, mm-hmm, blah, blah. So, yeah.
And that's what you're doing at your office too. Like that's what you did for me. When I came in there, you were the guy in the white coat that gave me good news for the first time.
Right, yeah.
Positive potential to, you know, get away from this pain. And that alone, 30% less pain after that first session. Yeah. And that was just an uphill climb after
and
that.
I mean, you're a great success story. And I remember having another girl who'd been in a car accident, and literally the doctors had said, you'll never run again. She broke down crying,
yeah,
in my first interview and stuff. And basically the same story as, yeah, you. We just convinced her that that's bullshit.
Yeah.
You're young. Your body should be able to heal itself. Let's get you working out. And she was doing CrossFit and all sorts of stuff.
That's awesome.
Doing fine. That said, I don't want people who are out there thinking, oh, all I need to do is basically, I don't even need to see Darren or whoever. I just basically need to just go down the gym and start working out. Sometimes there is something wrong, like I said before. So, mm-hmm. but you definitely have a point that, you know, I think over here, we've got so much technology now. Like there's an MRI on every corner in America. When I first came to the States, we had two in my state. Over wow. here, there's one everywhere. So getting access to this high technology is very easy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a great tool if it's used judiciously. But I think it's just used, it's over-prescribed. For so sure. you should try this other approach first. And like I said, getting an MRI half the time may not be the best thing initially.
Mm-hmm.
But it all depends on the initial evaluation. If you came into me and you said, I bent over and picked something up, and now my right leg's completely numb and I've been incontinent three times, dude, you need an MRI,
yeah.
you know, because that's probably a massive disc and a medical emergency. So you do need that health practitioner who understands things. But I'm just sort of trying to put the information out there. At times, some of this pathology that shows up on MRI, your disc bulges, fissures, all this stuff that they pick up, may or may not be relevant. And, you know, you probably had half of it beforehand. And a lot of the doctors now seem to be getting that, you know, because this is the latest stuff. They say it takes 10 years for something that's coming out in the research now to permeate the medical community. Mm. So the guys who are on the cutting edge usually are on it pretty quick, but everyone else, you know, you'll still be seeing practitioners. I mean, you'll be seeing practitioners 10 years from now who are still subscribing to theories that are sort of, I mean, chiropractic's 150 years old or how old it yeah. is. If you're still subscribing to just that theory, my thing would be maybe you should have a look around at some other stuff and add it to your toolbox.
For
because
sure.
I don't think that's, you know, things move on sort of thing and we discover other things.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. So for the people who are listening who are suffering from physical pain or know somebody who is, what do you say to them? Is there hope of healing like there was for me?
Yeah. I mean, again, it all depends on your problem.
Yeah.
You know, so chronic pain, depending on what it is, okay? So if you actually had, like my father, who has this knee that's just completely worn out, thankfully we have joint replacements and things like that. So assuming that's the problem, and that's where you need to see people who have lots of tools in their toolbox.
Yes.
That would be the solution for him. But, you know, someone who's been in a motor vehicle, like you, or someone like you, motor vehicle accident, you're young, you've got pain everywhere. Fibromyalgia is another example. Like I have patients who come in and they say, I've got fibromyalgia. And automatically I'm like, well, how do you know you've got fibromyalgia? No one really knows. Huh. It's a chronic pain syndrome huh. sort of characterized by a lot of pain all over your body. It's not too precise.
Hmm.
And when I hear the word fibromyalgia, I think of my muscles having fibrous stuff in it. I don't know about you, but that's what it sounds like to me, which doesn't sound good. And as far as I'm aware, they've never found anything in these fibromyalgic patients.
Hmm.
What they think it now is a hypersensitive central pain processing system.
Hmm.
So they're getting innocuous stimuli that is being interpreted as painful. And a lot of the fibromyalgia people, when you ask them, how's your sleep pattern? Terrible.
Hmm.
Are you under a lot of stress? I'm under a lot of stress. Do you exercise? I don't exercise. Usually they're nutrient. So they're very, very unhealthy people. So those people could turn their life around if they're prepared to. But often they're getting the messaging, you've got something wrong with you, you've got this thing called fibromyalgia, which they probably think there's things wrong in their muscles and stuff. And it's sort of like you could change your life if you want to. My biggest problem or challenge, I think, for all of us in the healthcare profession with a lot of these chronic patients is how to motivate them to actually do what we need them to do.
Yeah.
And often, even if you did it, you're not going to be pain-free. You've got to be realistic, but you'll have a better life. So
for sure.
Even if you had the same amount of pain, but you're fitter and stronger and moving more and more functional, that's got to be better than sitting on the couch, putting on weight and basically going to die 10 years prematurely.
It's even just better in your mind alone.
Yeah, it's
you all tell this, yourself you, there's hope.
And, yeah. So how do you motivate? I mean, we were just talking about coronavirus and, you know, it's been a year now and I haven't heard any politician say, get healthy.
Not one.
You know, in 6 months, you can turn your life around dramatically with diet and exercise. So I honestly, my chronic pain patients, a lot of the time, are stressed out of their brains, and stress is something that people completely underestimate on health. It is probably one of the most harmful things on health from what I'm reading. They don't sleep well. They've got poor sleep patterns. They wake up a lot. They go to bed late. They only get 4 hours. It's terrible. Whatever. Yeah, which only adds to your stress.
Yeah.
But half the time your stress is what's keeping you from sleeping. They don't exercise. Now, exercise will help stress and help your sleep patterns.
Yep.
And then their nutrition's bad. So if you get all four facets going, and they're all intertwined, aren't they? You'll live a much longer, healthier life. And I mean, just on exercise alone, which I try to sell to everybody, and it's so hard, it's incredible. They've done research where they followed 10,000 people in Britain and they looked at factors that predicted catastrophic health events, cancer, depression, heart attacks, strokes. And heart attacks and strokes are massive problems in the US. The single biggest risk factor, or the second single biggest risk factor, was not exercising.
Wow.
And it was a bigger risk factor. If you didn't exercise, that was worse than smoking. Wow. That was worse than being overweight. And it was worse than having diabetes combined. Wow. All three combined weren't as risky as not exercising. The highest risk factor, I think, was hypertension, which if you think about it, it's related to if you exercise and diet and stress as well. So, you know, and one of my guys I work with actually was just showing me an article where they compared people who exercise and diet, you know, eat well versus just eating well. And they looked at weight loss and other health parameters. And they found that, if you diet, you lose weight. If you diet and exercise, you lose weight. And they lost about the same amount of weight actually. But the exercise group had better blood pressure changes. And I can't remember what else they measured, but other things that exercise just give you health benefits that just dieting doesn't.
Yes.
Okay. So we're obsessed by body image in this country, whereas we should be obsessed more by health. So you can be a little bit overweight, but if you're exercising and eating well and sleeping well, you're going to be healthier than the skinny guy who doesn't do any of that, basically. So I try to sell exercise to everybody.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest limiting factor in exercise? I mean, you're managing a gym at the moment. What's the biggest limiting thing to get people to exercise?
I would say just their motivation.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Just convincing them.
So how do you motivate someone? So
a lot of convincing, right?
A big thing now, which I was never taught at college, which I think should be the first thing they teach every health professional, is a technique called motivational interviewing, which psychologists are experts at. It comes out of drug rehab, actually. And I can't do it. I've got some concepts of it, which I obviously do, but I'm not an expert at it. But you shift a person's mind so they make the change. So how do I get you, a sedentary person in pain who wants to get better, how do I shift you to actually do what I need to do? So when I'm advising people to exercise, I'm like, let's find something you don't hate, because if you hate it, you got no chance of doing it.
Yeah.
Set yourself extremely small goals, because if you set yourself a large goal, you may not reach it, and you've already demotivated yourself. So if you're going to go to the gym, I say, look, go to the gym. All I want you to do this week is go to the gym twice, get on the treadmill for 10 minutes and sit on the bike for 10 minutes, which isn't that much, or even less if they can't do that. That's your goal. You're going to do that. So most people achieve that. But then you'll see other people who are like, no, I'm going to go and work out for 3 hours every day.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 weeks they do that. And then the third week they feel like, oh, I don't want to work out. So they just give up because they just get demotivated. Mm-hmm. So this motivational interviewing stuff is again, it's not something that I'm good at. It's something I'm trying to work on, yeah. But it's out there. But how you shift people, I don't know. You know, you can lead a horse to water. How do you make it drink?
And I've been trying to figure that out since I've been involved in personal training too. Yeah. Like, what is that key you can turn people's heads in that gets them to realize, see the bigger picture of their health?
Well, everyone is different.
It is.
I mean, you know, you see it all the time. Someone has a heart attack. Well, they're exercising like a maniac once they've been rehabbed, you know, because they nearly died.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it goes back. I heard something about the coronavirus. It's like coronavirus kills you pretty quick. So everyone will wear masks and do radical. We've radically changed society based on something kills you quick. But actually diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, all this sort of stuff, they're killing way more people.
Yeah.
But it's an extremely slow-moving catastrophe.
So we're not worried about it.
So, and we know how to change it. Eat, sleep better, exercise, etc. But why don't we? So how come we'll do it? We changed the world in the last year because something kills you quick.
Yeah.
Something that's equally as deadly but just takes a lot longer. People just, do it tomorrow. I'll do it next week. So I don't know how to make people sort of get... Do it now, but just do it. Set yourself small goals and gradually build sort of thing. I don't have the answer to that.
You listen to Jordan Peterson?
Yes.
I like genius Jordan guy. Peterson. That's one of the phenomenons he's trying to crack is he wants to figure out, and he gives this really cool idea. Like we don't know what the world would look like and what society would look like if every human did what they knew they had to do. And we're just responsible because we all have that in different things, whether it's doing health or just being not procrastinating and getting our daily things done and not pushing anything aside. Why do we procrastinate and how do we overcome that and teach it in our generations? Like, what would the world look like if everyone just did what they had to do when they had to do it?
Yeah.
Right?
It'd be a lot better. I mean, it's like me every night. I'm like, I'm not going to have my wine tonight. But then I'm like, yeah, next week I'll start.
Yeah.
You know, and it's I don't know. It's just everyone's got a different.
Because we don't know the potential of a human being is because the people who do that and experience, like who display that they do things when they need to do it, turn out like Michael Jordan or turn out these guys going to the moon or something like that. Turn out like these people, super efficient. So if everyone was on that, like it's just a fascinating idea.
Yeah.
And I have been stuck on it with fitness and how to get that ball rolling. Because I, ever since I met you, once I was able to get back in the gym, I was able to completely 180 my health. Like I didn't eat vegetables when I saw you. I never like had vegetables.
Right.
I was like not a vegetable guy. Right. And now I'm like I just completely 180'd everything. And part of it was having to do with relieving my pain and knowing that I had like a straight forward direction now and I can climb up now. But yeah, I mean, I try to figure that out with everybody and it's almost addicting to find that key everybody, you know, and help motivate them and get them to be the person they want to be deep
down. I mean, we're honestly, if you look at the way the world works, we're so battling brainwashing of stuff that's bad for us.
Yes.
You know, most of the food ads are all crap.
Yep.
You know, food. I wouldn't have a problem. I mean, I'm all about free will and stuff, but with free will comes responsibility. So if you want to consistently be unhealthy, eat crap, not exercise, et cetera, then guys like you and me who are healthy, we're paying for it, for their medical care, basically.
Yes.
So I don't know the answer. So this is where with coronavirus, it's like, why are we not having a massive health campaign?
Yes. There should be online courses free that you should take on nutrition and how to build your immune system and get off the couch. It's crazy to me how that's never
it's
been
getting,
pushed.
You must admit it's getting better because the whole 10,000 steps and all that sort of stuff is great.
Yeah.
But nutrition, the food thing over here is just terrible. All of us are addicted to sugars, basically, processed foods. And, you know, the lack of knowledge of people is still amazing to me because to me I know, eat real food, don't eat processed food and you pretty well can't go wrong, even though I do it on occasion. But some people don't actually realise it, you know. They think they're eating healthy. They're eating pasta because they heard pasta's healthy for them. I'm like, pasta's not healthy for you. It's just it's one step up from sugar.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a refined carbohydrate. And I used to, when I was a kid, it was like, yeah, you got to eat lots of pasta if you're working out. It's energy. It's fuel for you. So there's all these conflicting, you know, stuff out there for the average punter. And you're just completely bombarded online and TV and that by probably the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
So it just takes a self-awareness thing that, I don't know, you could go into the whole, which I'm sure you have on your podcast, the social media, how it's influencing us in a positive or negative direction, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, we've talked about that for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It is. So it sounds, by the sounds of all of this conversation, you're pretty optimistic about the future of where the research on pain is going.
Yeah.
You think it'll eventually bleed into the medical field more and more?
Yeah, I think it's definitely shifting now.
Good.
I mean, it's amazing. When I first came to the States 20 years ago, manual therapy, which is the hands-on stuff, which chiropractors do that all the time, but physical therapists were not doing that much of it.
Hmm.
Within 20 years, it's gone from, now it's just standard practice. And in fact, if anything else, they're not putting as much emphasis on it, which is fine, because I don't believe it's the answer to everything either. And we're starting to look at the pain research, and we're looking at how people move, and we're blending things. And that's where the social media stuff's fantastic, because these young kids, they can get access to stuff that would take me months, if not, if I wanted to get exposed to a different system, I would have to go fly somewhere, travel somewhere, take a course. Now you just get online and you can watch videos and chat rooms and all this sort of stuff. So a lot of the young practitioners are much more being exposed to a lot of stuff, which is fantastic. And all they need to do is integrate it better with experience and not get... don't jump on one thing is my thing. Don't ever say this is the answer. There's multiple answers for different things, and that's the problem. So yeah, I think we're going to continue to improve. There's these brilliant researchers. The guys that sort of shifted me, like I said, was Peter O'Sullivan. He's a physical therapist. There's a guy, Lorimer Moseley. So if you're listening,
Lorimer Moseley?
Yeah, Lorimer Moseley, Moseley. Look up Lorimer Moseley TED Talk pain.
Cool.
I think I might have showed you.
Yeah,
it's the guy's walking in the outback and gets bitten by a snake. And
yes.
Very entertaining, very funny. And it describes how, and he's got lots of good video examples of how your brain interprets things differently, visual illusions and things like that. So he's another brilliant guy that's doing a lot of research. And there's a whole bunch of other guys out there. This is the latest hot thing in therapy. The only concern I have is that now everyone's jumping on that bandwagon and they're forgetting about all the other stuff, which I also think is relevant. You know, manual therapy has a place, you know, massage, moving joints, but you've just got to pick the guy. So if you're massaging everyone, like if I'd just done massage on you or manual therapy, we would have got nowhere.
Yeah.
Because you weren't that type of patient. Mm-hmm. So I think once people add this mind pain thing into their toolbox and they're incorporating it with other stuff, the way people move, there's the fellowship I did in St. Louis. There's a very famous, well-respected PT called Shirley Salmon.
Okay.
She's convinced that most pain comes from the fact that we move, you know, we're not moving well, and then we overload an area of the joint and the body, and you get pain there. So if I change the way you move, the pain will go away. And I've seen her do miraculous things. That's why I went back and did a fellowship with that group, because I was like, how the hell are they doing that? I can't do that.
Wow.
So I've added to my toolbox. So, but I don't think everybody fits that paradigm. Like you were... they would have found things with you and probably had you moving differently. Now, they may have got, by getting you to move differently and you had less pain, they may have got you to the same point. I don't know. Mm. I personally think you needed a bit more of a conversation on understanding pain.
Definitely.
So, again, you got to pick the right tool for the right problem.
Very interesting. Because it didn't get rid of my pain completely, but it helped me lower it so I can get back into
shape.
Yeah,
you got to get back to life. Mate, I'm in pain all the time. The older you get, unfortunately, I got like a bit of a dicky neck and my hip hurts and all that. But because I know what I know, it's like, it's not catastrophic.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't sit in your mind the same way.
No, it's just, and I'm smart. Because I'm trained in the way I'm trained, I know what I should do and what I shouldn't do.
Yes.
And basically I know that I need to just keep exercising,
mm-hmm.
and I just have to change my routine around. I can't do what I did when I was 20.
You know,
I have to warm up a lot more. I don't push as much weight, et cetera.
Yeah.
So things like that.
People don't realize how we've evolved for our, at least human body forms, whether we were human or somewhat human,
yep.
millions of years in this type of form. And resistant training, like resisting gravity, is healthy for our bodies.
Yeah.
It's healthy for our bone density.
We're designed to move,
we're designed to move. We're designed to swing and hang from branches. Like our shoulders are meant to do that. And that's why a lot of people suffer from shoulder pain, because gravity's just pulling them to the ground for their whole life.
Oh, God,
that's why hanging therapy helps a lot of patients.
I mean, the biggest... One of the things I deal with the most is people just sit at a desk 90% of the day,
you know,
and they end up with shoulders that are droopy and their head and their posture and all that. And then over years, you actually end up with muscles that are longer and weaker.
Mm.
So when those people come in and they have pain, I give them a series of exercises to counteract that. Because that's their main problem.
Yeah.
It's not a pain that's in their head. It's the fact that they're basically sitting at a desk for too long and they're putting a stretch on a muscle, and after a while the muscle says, hey, I'm not happy about this.
Yeah.
So we have to either change the setup of the desk, or we have to give them exercises, you know.
Yeah.
And generally, if you're working out and if you're at a desk all day but you get up a few times and you actually do exercises and stuff, you don't have that pain.
No,
you know? So... Yeah, movement is definitely, we were designed to move.
Yeah, we are.
I'm pretty sure in third world countries where they end up sort of carrying their whole house around on their neck and stuff like that, a lot of they don't have as much back pain and neck pain as us, I don't think. Or if they do, it's sort of like, it's not shutting their life down the way we sort of shut our whole life down, because we have, I've got some pain, you know, and the doctor told me I've got a degenerated disc, so therefore I've got to not move this, and you just go down a dark road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that there was a doctor who studied this culture who never experienced like chronic back pain. And he didn't understand why. And it turns out they didn't have chairs. They didn't have modern chairs.
Right.
They were squatting for their seats instead.
Yep.
And that was like the natural way we've been doing it for our bodies are meant to do it.
Yep.
And these chairs were all sitting on our tailbones all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just not natural. And that's where they say some of it could come from over the generations too.
There's a new book out. I just started listening to it. It's called Exercise by Daniel Lieberman.
Okay.
Lieberman.
Love all the references.
He's a anthropologist.
Okay.
So he's looking at exercise from the perspective of...
Ooh.
So he's taken treadmills up into like Africa.
What?
And looking at the way people move and all this. And I've only just started the book.
This is cool.
But I thought, man, I should listen to this because he's coming at it from a different angle.
It's an audio book?
Just come out. He's super interesting, that guy. Cool. I mean, remember when there was that whole barefoot running craze?
Yeah.
You know, which, again, that's a bit debatable. But the theory was, you know, we weren't designed to put cushions on our feet.
Mm-hmm.
When you put a cushion on your foot and you start running, you run differently than when you don't have a cushion on your foot. So when you run with a cushion on your foot, i.e. your shoe, you heel strike. When you heel strike, there's a different sort of force production up through your body, which can overload areas that isn't always great. Whereas when you barefoot run, you forefoot strike a little bit more, which changes your pattern of running and redistributes load. Now, that said, when everyone started doing barefoot running, they suddenly are getting fractures in their feet. And so you've got to go to it very gradually if it's even appropriate for you. But it is, you know, the body, we do a lot of things with the body that probably we weren't designed to, if you look at an evolution point of view.
Yeah.
So
I knew this doctor who was on Rogan's podcast talking about how he was helping people with their sleep apnea by giving them jaw workouts. And he had this like, I think he may have been an anthropologist or studied old human bones. And he saw that our mouths used to be wider. So he started doing jaw exercises because we used to chew on tougher foods that we don't anymore.
Yeah.
And so his jaw started becoming wider and the roof of his mouth was widening.
Right.
And he said like he was getting gaps in his teeth, like his jaw was getting more powerful and it was helping him, his airways breathe more.
Yeah.
Like it was weird.
That's funny. There's another book I just was listening to called Breathe that's just come out. And I forget, I heard this guy interviewed on NPR. I don't know if it was the same guy. He's a journo. But he was talking about that, that like the facial features has changed over time, and mouth breathing's not good for you. You should be using your nose. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy, I mean, there's a lot of, a guy, Wim Hof, who I
think
is on Rogan and all that, which I've just started listening to him. But breathing, that's another thing, you know, that I'm no expert on. But, you know, you can influence your health a lot with that sort of stuff. But,
you know, everything we're talking about right now, I feel like the monks have gotten this figured out for a while. The pain part, the breathing part, and the meditation, quieting your mind, exercising and being still. Like, all those things they've been practicing for thousands of years, and they're the only ones still doing that type of practice. Yep. And those guys the stuff they can do is incredible. Yeah. They can focus so hard on their heart rate, and they could bring it up to like 300 beats per minute. They insane. Thought he was flatlining when they put him up to an EKG. They thought this guy, his heart stopped, but it was so fast that, and he was just sitting this perfectly still. That's and he meditated his heartbeat to like 300 beats per minute.
Yeah, interesting.
Isn't that insane?
I remember listening to Tim. So a lot of successful people that I've sort of been listening to all rave about meditation.
Yes.
And I don't really meditate, which I probably need to get into, although I think when I exercise I sort of zone out because it's similar.
Yeah.
But like, I was listening to a podcast with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he reckons when he was stressed out of his brains in the early days when he's in California, and that he met a guy, taught him how to meditate, raved about it. Really? Tim Ferriss raves about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's basically the exercise for your mind, isn't it? It's like switch off your mind and I always wondered why the monks would be chanting or something. I'm like, what the hell is that all about?
Yeah.
And they're just doing a focus on one thing.
Yes.
And mindfulness, which is the big thing nowadays, isn't it? Mindfulness is you're trying to clear your mind.
Yeah.
So you just focus on one thing, and then when you start thinking about whatever's stressing you out, go back, get away from it. And then they say just by doing that 10 to 15 minutes a day, the changes in health, like your blood pressure levels and all this is crazy. Yeah,
yes.
You know, so.
And it kind of works the same when you quiet your mind and you start and you start becoming mindful of your thoughts coming in as they kind of like cars driving past a road when your thoughts come in. When you quiet it that much, people eventually emotions start to change for people because it's kind of like what you said with pain, how pain is it's, if you get stabbed in the leg, your body's receiving that input to the brain, and it's still real, but that can be minimized or by being aware of it.
Yes.
Or not aware of it changes the effects of it, the feeling of it. It's the same thing with emotions and pain.
I was reading a book on anxiety. I forget what the hell it was called. But
you just read one letter books? One name, one word
books? Oh, no, it was a longer one than that. I can't remember. Control your anxiety or something. Because I think everyone's anxious.
Oh, yeah.
And the older you get, the worse it gets. But when you have a panic attack or a mini version of it, that is a primate brain response. Mm-hmm. That is, your heart rate gets up and your cognitive brain might be saying, this is silly, I'm getting stressed out because my girlfriend didn't call me back last night or whatever. Meanwhile, you're still having a meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
So the way to get into that, to shut it down a bit, is you don't want to use your cognitive brain because it's not working. You're saying, well, I'm being silly about whatever is stressing me out, but I'm still having a panic attack. You've got to use things that actually work on the primate side of your brain or whatever they call it, reptilian brain or whatever, and that, like breathing and things like that. So when you're having an anxiety attack, just doing a lot of deep breathing, it calms you down. You try it. Next time you're stressing out, just do some deep breathing. Physiologically, it winds you down.
Wow.
So, fascinating. Yeah, and exercise is part of this as well. You know, go out and do a good workout, and a lot of your problems are still there that are stressing you out, but you just feel better about them to a degree. And then, of course, you do need to address your problems, you know, obviously, and that's a whole other five podcasts, I'm sure.
Yeah, because like with these hyper-aware, like self-aware monkeys that are still having to negate our primal emotions and instincts that are triggered sometimes by random stuff, bad traffic or breakup or something like the losing someone you love. And that makes so much sense that you can't deal with it by thoughts necessarily. You have to do some sort of practice.
Yeah, yeah. How do you shut down that part of your brain? Yeah,
you have to combat it with a primitive technique, in a sense.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool.
I mean, I think Rogan talks about it as the monkey brain. Or whatever, you know, I've always thought this. There's lots of human. There's lots of people walking around, but not all of them are humans because most of them are controlled by their primate brain.
Yes, like autopilot.
You know? Yeah, mm-hmm. And this is why when you watch the news, you're like, what the hell? This guy's gone and shot his wife and da-da-da-da. Because he's just let his primate brain rule. You know? I get as angry and jealous as the next guy, but my human side of me goes, well, going and shooting someone just isn't civilized behavior. Mm-hmm. So I just think society is just full of people who just need to start learning. There's a reptilian brain that makes you do some crazy stuff, mm-hmm. and you need to learn to control that. That makes you a human sort of thing. So there's a whole bunch of guys talking about that.
And what scares me is the movie Idiocracy. Have you seen that?
I don't know if I've seen
it. Oh, man. Definite recommendation. I'll have to watch it. But it's basically just shows how in the future, like, smart people are breeding less than dumber people. And so in the future, it's just going in that direction and extrapolating. So in the future, there's far less people, intelligent people, and way more.
Well, we were having this debate, like, is it intelligence? So I remember a quote from Gore Vidal where he was saying that if you listen to late night radio and the sports channel, you'll have these people who call up who you might think aren't that intelligent or clever, mm-hmm. when you listen to their philosophy on life and all this sort of stuff. But actually, when they're talking about baseball, they're bloody geniuses. They're talking about incredibly intricate things and stuff.
Yeah.
And Gore Vidal's thing is that people are smart. They just apply their brain to the wrong things at times.
Oh, okay.
So I sort of agree in a way. Like, I think as you can nurture people to think. And this is what we try to do when we, in our physical therapy fellowships, mm-hmm. we're trying to teach them how to think. Like I said, everything's grey, laterally think, don't be dogmatic. And you can apply that to life.
Yeah.
And you can teach it, but it's hard. And I don't think they teach that at school. I was never really taught that at school.
It's like a method of thinking that you can apply to anything
Absolutely.
In your life.
Absolutely, yeah.
The couple podcasts ago when I had that philosopher on, that's kind of what we got into. There was this ancient philosopher who, by using the techniques of what philosophy does, so by keeping like an agnostic kind of flexible mind, by applying. So if you have an issue, this guy named Lucretius came up, or he was trying to contemplate what the universe is made out of. What is everything made out of, right? So he starts applying all these philosophical questions of why things move and all these things. And he gets to the conclusion that because thoughts flow so quickly, They must be made of particles that are rounded like water, because water flows effortlessly in a direction. So thoughts must work the same way. And he then extrapolated and said that the universe must be made up of tiny particles, that everything, there's no solid object, and everything is basically vibrating, moving atoms all. And this guy was, there was no microscopes back then. He was an ancient philosopher, but just from thinking hard and using that technique and applying, putting a situation on a question on it, he was able to come up with
molecular theory.
Yeah. With today's,
the thing is, you could say that, but until you go off and test it scientifically, this is the thing. This is why the scientific method is, okay, that's a nice theory. Now, how do we test it?
Yes.
You know, and unfortunately in medicine at the moment, you know, we're still so far from understanding how everything works. Like every 10 years, we're coming up with something different as to why something works. So within my profession, we had these theories on, if you have a sore neck and I push on your neck, we're loosening up a joint. Now, 10 years later, everyone would say that's not right. It's actually, you're putting input into the pain system and changing that pain sensitivity threshold.
Wow.
So, you know, next 10 years, what will the next theory be? Yeah. So it's that black box again. Yeah. So, and that's it's a big problem in society is people don't think like that. They read something on Facebook and it's like, I believe that because of Facebook. The amount of times people send me stuff and I just put in whatever it is, fake or fraud, and then there's 1,000 hits showing you that it's complete rubbish.
Yep.
But then that person, if they believe it, will just say to you, how do you know those 1,000 hits weren't complete rubbish? And it's like, I agree, you know, unless – I don't know where it ends or how you work out what the truth is anymore, but within the scientific method, you do an experiment and you have a theory and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And science seems to have been somewhat debatable in the last few years, you know.
It's like,
We just want an opinion. And,
yes.
And the opinion fits my belief system, therefore I'm not prepared to listen to other opinions.
Yep.
And that happens within the medical profession a lot.
In a lot of professions, even history, like historians hold on to things. They don't want change because they got degrees in it.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, that's why everything needs to be grounded in logic, like logical thinking.
Because I'm fascinated by belief systems. Like, why do you believe what you believe? And you believe it for a whole multitude of factors. And as long as you're questioning that stuff, I think it's healthy. It's as long as if you start going, whatever I believe is the only way, there's a problem.
Yes.
And there's a lot of that in society at the moment. People believe this is the only way. And there's a lot of that in medicine, you know, this is the only way. Like, your pelvis is out of alignment. My professor at college told me this is a true fact. Well, did it occur to you that maybe your professor doesn't know what he's talking about? So maybe he could, but he might not. So maybe go out and see, do a bit more investigation.
Seek other advice, for sure.
Sort of thing. So that's how we need to think.
For sure. So for people who are listening, how can they get in touch with you? How can they get an appointment?
I think currently I work for a company at Lakeshore Bone and Joint in Crown Point.
Okay.
I have a website that's my own little sort of PT website, which is ephysio.online.
Okay.
So E as in egg, physio, PHYSIO.online. And then there's an email on that and my cell phone and stuff. And
cool.
You can contact me there. But Lakeshore Bone and Joint is where I'm in Crown Point's where I'm working at the moment. But, you know, in years from now, who knows what I'll be doing of thing. But that's where I would go. And then if people are more interested in what we've been talking about, like I said, Peter O'Sullivan, low back pain will take you to a video. Lorimer Moseley, TED Talk will take you to that sort of stuff.
Great. Thank you for all of this advice.
I mean, I'm glad you did well.
Great conversation. Yes.
One of my good success stories.
Great, great. I'm, and now you can show them this video if you ever don't spend so much time talking.
I will.
Yeah,
thanks.
I appreciate it a lot. I hope this hits somebody out there that, you know, it can help, because I'm telling you, it helps. It helped me a lot. And if you are in chronic pain or in any pain, go see Darren. If you're local here, or if you can make the drive, go check him out, because he does great, great work, as you can hear. So appreciate your time.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, hit that thumbs up or like button, or even share this podcast with some friends. And make sure you subscribe to my channel and all listening platforms to stay up to date with all the new content coming out. That's The Matt Rich Podcast on all listening platforms. If you'd like to support the channel, visit my Patreon at patreon.com/TheMattRichPodcast. I love you all, and I will see you next time.